The Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everybody. We will proceed with case number one, please. The United States versus Brian K. Jones.
May it please the court, I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Public Defender's Office, Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant Brian Jones. In this case, Mr. Jones is sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for 4 grade C violations of the conditions of his supervised release. However, that sentence was plainly unreasonable in light of the fact that he was making some progress while on supervised release.
Now, are we talking simply about the judgment call of the district court, are you alleging there's some error of law involved here?
It's probably mixed. A little hard to quantify the plainly unreasonable standard as being necessarily either or. I would say it's a mixed question.
Judge certainly understood her options.
It appeared that way, yes.
What happened in that last 60-day hiatus? There was a pretty extensive hearing. At the end of the pretty extensive hearing, the judge let this go for another 60 days. What happened during that period in terms of your client's conduct that made the judge make up her mind the way she did?
I'm not sure entirely. I know that he continued to have problems, although he did get a job again during that period.
The moving company, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It looked like the clincher was the fact that he overslept the day he was supposed to be in court and ended up coming to court.
She mentions that, but I'm wondering about whether anything else happened or whether that she was aware of when she made the decision.
If I remember correctly, he did continue to test dirty. During that time.
Did she know that?
Yes, she was aware of that.
How?
I believe the probation officer told her. It came out in argument. I'm not too sure there was much. There was some admission that he was continuing to not do what he was supposed to and make... Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Not that he was testing dirty. He had not made all of his treatment appointments. And he said that was because of limited funds, he couldn't afford to go search for a job and then get to the family guidance center where he was supposed to be treatment.
There was a comment to that effect in his statement to the court.
Right.
But it was difficult to tell whether he was referring to something that had happened in the immediate past or something that had happened earlier on, not in that 60-day window.
That's true. The record isn't as clear as it could be. It looked to me like it was within the 60 days, but to be honest, I'm not sure, just reading the cold record.
Mm-hmm. You were not counsel at the...
No, I was not. But even the government, as I was saying, conceded that Mr. Jones had not been a complete failure on supervised release. The probation officer saw signs that he was trying to do the right thing. She even told defense counsel that he didn't realize how far Mr. Jones had actually come from where he started. And as His Honor pointed out, Mr. Jones certainly had problems that the court was well aware of. This showed that Mr. Jones certainly needed more structure in his life, perhaps a period of, maybe even a long period of inpatient drug treatment.
Well, of course, the judge made a determination that he was not capable of amenable to supervision. So, I mean, isn't this just a matter of degree between your estimation of what the man needs, more structure in his life, and the judge's estimation that he's... beyond the point where this can be done in a non-incarcerated situation?
Probably, but under this standard where we're talking differences between one sentence to another sentence, it's probably all a matter of degree where the line is between reasonable and unreasonable.
And we use an objective standard of reasonableness is what you're urging then?
If that is possible. I would point out to the court that even if Mr. Jones had been found guilty of possessing instead of just simply using heroin, in federal court he would have been looking at a maximum sentence of 2 years imprisonment due to his prior offense. If he'd had two priors, which he didn't, it would have been 3 years rather than the 5 years he got. Obviously, there's some additional violations that need to be taken into account in the breach of trust, so I'm not suggesting that it should go right there, but in that neighborhood. And the court didn't seem to consider another part of Section 3553 that she was supposed to consider, what would provide him with the needed educational or vocational training, medical or other correctional treatment. And simply warehousing him for 5 years in federal prison isn't going to do that.
Doesn't the court's colloquy with counsel at the initial hearing on this supervised release revocation make it pretty clear she was aware of that obligation?
No, I don't believe it does. She was focusing, she may have been, but it's not clear on the record. She was focusing on his prior offense, and she was very upset by the fact that he got a downward departure for cooperating with the government initially and was now back before her for violating a supervised release. And certainly she was allowed to take that into account. However, the overall section of 3553 certainly seems to imply that Congress didn't envision a case where a sentence of over six times the suggested guideline range would ever be reasonable. And if there is such a case, this is not it. Therefore, this court should remand this case to the district court with directions for it to impose a more reasonable sentence on Mr. Jones. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Manish Shah. I represent the United States. The district court sentence was entirely reasonable given the circumstances of this case. As the district court put it, the defendant received a big break at sentencing for the initial offense, a 94-month downward departure. He was looking at 188 months at the
lower. Do you really have a right to take that into consideration at this point?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The initial offense is a factor to be considered. In fact, the punishment on revocation and supervised release is a part of the punishment for the initial offense. And the maximum penalty of 60 months under the statute is driven by the gravity of the underlying conviction. It was a Class A felony, and that's what drives the maximum on revocation. So it is a factor that the district court ought to consider and should consider and did in this case.
What had this fellow been doing? What were the basic facts of the underlying conviction?
She was, as reflected in the PSR, the self-described manager of security for a vast heroin ring in the south side of Chicago, which had the dubious distinction of being the first gang to bring Karachi heroin into the south side of Chicago. And two of his co-defendants went to trial, received life sentences. He was legally responsible for the distribution of 10 to 30 kilograms of heroin. And that's what triggered a base offense level of 36, which had a guideline range of 188 months at the low end.
Did he testify at the trial of these other defendants?
The record we have here, Your Honor, doesn't reflect whether he did or did not testify, and I don't know the answer to that.
Are his violations only in not cooperating with the probation department and not reporting for his drug treatment and therapy?
Those two violations, in addition to testing positive,
right,
and failure to medicate his drug addiction, as well as failure to take the antidepressants that he was required to take, which was part of the modification of his supervised release that happened around December of 2000. He was brought in on not a rule to show cause for revocation, but a modification. He was given an opportunity, and he agreed to modify to get mental health treatment.
Can you explain what her thinking was when she said that he couldn't be rehabilitated, that he was in such condition, or that his entire 9-year program had shown that? And just what convinced her of that? Can you tell us that?
The record shows that from January of 2000, when the defendant is released from prison, until June of 2001, when the sentence is imposed here, he repeatedly failed to get with the program.
What do you mean, get with it?
He
didn't report.
He failed to.
And when he came in, he tested positive for drugs and this.
That's correct, Your Honor. He failed to report. he fails to, when he does report and test, he fails to test clean. He does not respond to home visits, scheduled home visits that the probation officer scheduled with him. And he fails to submit the monthly reports that he's required to submit. Those are the four violations that he admitted to.
Now it'll be easier. What did he do to cooperate with the probation department?
Unfortunately, the record doesn't reflect what his successes were in this program. The probation officer made a comment, apparently, to defense counsel at some point that he had made some progress, but the record doesn't show what exactly that was. And in his own comment to the judge during the colloquy, he explained that he could not work his drug treatment and his employment seeking opportunities together, and he just could not follow what was required of him. And the judge found that to be a great disappointment, and the judge was the one who was in the best position to evaluate him. She had sentenced him in 1992. She had observed him during the rule to show cause proceedings, and the defense counsel below was new to the case. The prosecutor below was new to the case. The judge was in the best position to make this call.
Please, go ahead, Judge. Go ahead, Judge.
He received an initial 94 months imprisonment.
That's correct.
How much time of that did he serve?
I believe he served from 1992 to about January of 2000 when he was released, roughly 8 years, I believe.
Where was he incarcerated during that initial period?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. The record we've been able to reconstruct doesn't show where he was initially.
Can you give me your perspective on what he did during the last 60 days after the judge initially continued this matter? Does the record affirmatively show what, if any, mishaps he had during that period?
I think the best evidence of that is, as Your Honor pointed out, his statement to the judge when she asked him what had happened, and he explained that he couldn't make his appointments. And I also inferred from that that was referring to the last 60 days, that he was not able to get to his meetings with the probation officer and continued to fail to report. This was a judgment call by the district court, who evaluated all the appropriate factors in determining that 60 months is appropriate here. And for all those reasons, we...
Excuse me, let me ask you, how the district judge said his original sentence was 15% lower than that indicated by the guidelines. What did this total time, if he served this time, bring him up to?
About 154 months.
Which is what she's indicating, because he was 50% below, would have been a sentence, could have been imposed at the initial.
That's correct. He, under the guidelines, the low end was 188 months. The government would respectfully request that this court affirm the sentence imposed by the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Is there anything else that you wish to add, counsel?
First, I'd like to point out that failure to take his medication was not an alleged violation. Mr. Jones's part, it may or may not have been a problem, and certainly needed, apparently, the medication. And as to what he had done successfully, initially when he got out, he...
Yeah, that's easier if you can tell us that.
Got a job. He got a job. He was able to get an apartment. He got a car. He was two-thirds of the way towards getting his GED. He was even getting, you'll believe it's laser treatment to get his gang tattoos removed. Unfortunately, the job he got was seasonal, and when he lost it, he also lost the apartment and the car, and apparently, due to lack of coping skills, I suspect that's usually the problem, returned to using heroin. However, he didn't return to anything involving sales of heroin or commit any other criminal violations, and he did continue to go look for a job afterwards. He asked for help, took some, but not full advantage of the help that was offered, and there's no evidence in the record whether he was aware that he could have asked for help in getting to these appointments. I don't know whether he was or not, but it appears he probably wasn't from his statement.
The statement, rather the trial transcript, indicates that defense counsel was fairly deferential to the district judge on this one. What can you enlighten us? Any, I mean, was this tactical or was this intimidation?
I
or just frankly, a reaction to what perhaps was perceived as a lost cause. But there was you don't see enough. Like the counsel for the United States just said, you know, that all the judge was the person in the room who knew it all, and both people were new. But that really doesn't. That might excuse government counsel. It doesn't excuse the defense counsel.
I wish I knew, Your Honor. That was not even our office. It was this district's office, and I don't know. I'm disappointed that the record is the way it is. I think there should have been more evidence, perhaps even expert testimony on the nature of relapse and addiction. But I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. The court will take the case under advisement. Proceed.